Chapter 30. I am not proposing that we surrender, Admiral Reichert insisted, relying on artificially produced hormones to give him the appearance of confidence and aggression, which he didn't feel. His self-confidence had, in fact, been thoroughly shattered by the destruction of the Doomsday Fleet. Not just by that one devastating setback. There had been an escalating series of setbacks, first when he was merely a fleet admiral, then after he maneuvered himself into control of the fleet's general staff. The hegemony public's trust in their military was challenged when the Maxalt's people were shocked to discover the ghost ship was not operated by the Bosphorak, and therefore the campaign to punish their clients was not only not justified, it was counterproductive. It weakened the entire coalition at a time when the Maxalt's needed every bit of combat power they could muster because of another shocking discovery. That humans were flying the ghost ship, and had been conducting clandestine operations all across the galaxy for years, including an operation to sucker the Maxalts into weakening their own coalition. If that was not bad enough, humans could not be punished for their upstart lack of respect, because they now had control of Elder weapons, hidden in strategic locations throughout the territory of the Maxalts and Rindaloo. Reichert gained, then held his powerful position throughout those disasters, even when humans later struck back. By the time humans demonstrated the ability to shut down wormhole networks, his control of the general staff was absolute. His fellow admirals had tied their fate to his. They could not afford to let him fall, or he would take them down with him. They even went along with his extreme doomsday plan, trading their souls for their survival. Now, even that doomsday option was not possible. The entire galaxy knew the leaders of the hegemony had intended to kill them all to hold on to a tiny flicker of hope that the Maxalts could someday rule the galaxy alone. Shockwaves of that disaster, a catastrophe in both strategic and political terms, were still reverberating within Maxalt society. Not just within their society. The revelation had caused clients to formally protest and for at least three coalition partners to approach the Rindaloo. The hegemony fleet was hard-pressed to prevent open rebellion by clients, to the point where Maxalt's civilian ships were not permitted to travel in client territory without a strong military escort. Reichert had to salvage something from the situation, or the government's civilian leadership would sacrifice him in a heartbeat. His fellow admirals on the general staff were no longer certain allies. They saw the disaster as an opportunity to slip free of the noose that encircled all their necks, leaving him to hang alone.
We will never surrender. We will be patient, in the certain knowledge that it is our destiny to claim our rightful place as leaders of all civilization, he said, echoing words in the message from Captain Iliath. That disgraced officer may very well be executed for treason because she had not even attempted to attack Valkyrie during their encounter. But her words were useful. The humans are young, primitive, foolish. They will make a mistake, and we must be ready to exploit this situation to our advantage.
You propose we agree to the terms offered by the criminal bishop? Admiral Wendaddy asked, adding into his tone a dramatic note of incredulity.
I propose we talk to the humans, learn more about them, find their weaknesses and exploit them. Human society is fractured into factions, much like the clans of the Kristang.
He said that name with undisguised disgust and was rewarded by agreeing murmurs from the audience. No one in the hegemony had the slightest respect for that bickering species of undisciplined children.
By talking, we can discover how to split the humans apart to our advantage. Perhaps.
He hung his head and shook it slowly, a gesture so unexpected that the general staff chamber fell into a tense hush.
Perhaps. He looked up again. I was too hasty to declare all is lost, and it was time to activate our long-planned doomsday scenario.
His emphasis on long-planned was to remind the audience that previous generations of leadership had conceived of the notion to flee the galaxy.
Our destiny awaits us here. All of us. If we can split human society, we can gain a powerful new ally against our ancient enemy. Do I have your approval to recommend we open negotiations with the humans?
After debate, much more debate than Reichert expected, which showed the precariousness of his position, the general staff recommended their government approach the humans to begin discussions.
Only 3 days after we reactivated the wormhole network that we temporarily faked shutting down, the Rotten Kitties announced they wanted to talk with us and the Rindaloo. I had two reactions to the welcome news. Publicly, I pumped a fist and offered high fives to everyone on the bridge. Privately, a few minutes later, I went to my cabin and barfed up my breakfast. "Are you okay, Joe?" Skippy asked with genuine concern, and not just concern that his bots needed to wash another towel.
"Yeah, I hate lying to my crew. The stress is..."
I held out my hands. They trembled a bit.
"Getting to me. Hey, I feel like barfing and I don't even have a stomach. Sorry."
"Why?"
"I got you into this. It was my idea to fake the network shutdown."
"No problemo. It gave me an opportunity to screw with the entire galaxy."
"Thanks for being understanding. It helps. Friends are supposed to have each other's backs, right?"
"Yes. Still, I appreciate that I can vent to someone."
"Again, no problemo, dude.
To be clear, you're not planning to mope and whine much longer about your feelings?" He gagged.
"Why are you such an asshole?" I asked, but I had to laugh.
Skippy being, well, Skippy, felt normal. Right then, I needed life to feel normal. Like I wasn't keeping a terrible secret that had the potential to destroy all of humanity.
"Never mind."
Looking at myself in the bathroom mirror, I decided there was no need to put on a fresh uniform. Doing that would be noticed, and the crew would get suspicious. Splashing cold water on my face, I felt better. "We won," I told myself. We had bent the enemy to our will by force of arms, and by the awesomeness of Skippy. The Maxulks, of course, were way too freaking arrogant to admit that they agreed to talks because of our threat to crash more wormhole networks. Their official announcement included haughty language about how they, as leaders of their righteous coalition, had a responsibility to curb future reckless actions of the young and impetuous humans.
Ha!
Over the years, people have called me a lot of things, but impetuous is new to me. I had to Google it to make sure I understood the reference, because I didn't want to be, you know, impetuous about it. Whatever. It really doesn't matter whether the Maxulks admitted they were frightened. Everyone in the galaxy knew the asshole kitties were terrified of our twice demonstrated ability to selectively shut down entire networks of wormholes. All the other species knew the arrogant Maxulks were frightened of us, because every species was also frightened of what we impetuous primitives might do next. Hell, I didn't know what we would do next, because I really didn't have a plan for the sudden outbreak of peacetime. Fortunately, that question was above my pay grade. The nations of UNEF would lead the negotiations with the two senior species, which weren't even scheduled at that point. Back on the bridge, I waved for Strebik to remain in the command chair.
"You have the con, Exo. I'm just..."
I looked at the main display, which showed the relay station hovering off to the side and nothing else. No threats, no formation of Navy ships we had to coordinate with. Just us. "Taken in the moment. We should have a special dinner tonight to celebrate."
"Yes, sir," she agreed with a twinkle in her eyes.
"What?" I asked. "Oh, please tell me we're not going to have some weird vegetable thing."
"No. It's something new. You'll like it."
She grinned. "I heard about it a couple weeks ago, but I've been keeping it a surprise." The problem with having a new executive officer, one who had not served aboard the ship in another capacity, is that I still didn't know Strebik all that well. Was she screwing with me and I would have to eat zucchini surprise? Or were we getting juicy steaks for dinner? As dinner time approached, I waited impatiently in my office. Strebik had notified me I was banned from the galley, or the passageways near the galley. Apparently I was not even allowed to smell whatever was cooking there. I had no idea what special treat was being served for dinner. Asking Skippy for a hint was useless. He was under strict orders to avoid the subject.
"Come on, Skippy, help a brother out."
"No way, Jose."
His avatar folded his arms across his chest and shook his head.
"Give me a hint, please. All I want to know is, will I like it?"
"You're asking me?"
"Good point." The crew was no help either. Some of them had "I know something you don't know" smirks on their faces, which had me worried. In my desk drawer were ration bars that tasted like compressed sawdust. I debated eating one, so I wouldn't need to eat much at dinner. Instead, I decided to trust my still new XO. That was a good call. What was for dinner? OMG. If you had asked me if it was possible to combine two of my favorite foods, I would have said that required arcane forbidden magic. Thankfully, I would have been wrong to say that. Did we have steaks for dinner? No. Lobster rolls? Also no. On my plate was something so incredible, I just stared at it for a full minute while the crew watched me. It was called a Fluff Screamer. Strebick knew about it because one of our pilots is from Girardville, Pennsylvania, where the Fluff Screamer is a local favorite. Imagine this, if you dare. A cheeseburger with raw onions, a hot and spicy chili sauce, a pat of butter on top, and... wait for it. Wait for it. Marshmallow fluff. Genius, right? The sweet goodness of fluff helps cut the fiery heat of the chili sauce and onions, with all the flavors combining into something so indescribably delicious it... well, like I said, it can't be described. Seated across the table from me, Strebick waited anxiously for me to pick up the screamer and taste it. Hunched over the table so the juice, butter, sauce, and fluff didn't drip on my uniform, I bit into it.
Oh, that is so good,
I mumbled, my mouth full because I immediately took another bite. There were also French fries and potato salad and three bean salad and other backyard cookout style foods. To be polite, I sampled a bit of everything to show the crew I appreciated their efforts. Here's a trivia question. How many fluff screamers can Joe Bishop eat? The answer is 3. How many did I want to eat? More than 3, to tell the truth. Even the crew was impressed when I shoveled the last burger in my mouth and licked fluff, hot sauce, and melted cheese off my fingers. Hey, I was stress eating. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. When we arrived back at Fob Jaguar, I let Strebick brief Admiral Zhao while I made another call. Did I call Margaret? No, my first call was to my father. Did I tell him the good news about the kiddies agreeing to peace talks? No, I told him about the Fluff Screamer. He demanded to know why he hadn't heard about such an incredible food combination before and agreed with me that the good citizens of Pennsylvania were jerks for keeping it a secret. I promised that when I got down to the surface, we would make a batch of screamers on my parents' backyard grill. Then I had to call back when I remembered I had ended the call without even mentioning our success in getting the enemy to the table for negotiations. My second call was to Margaret, who listened with increasing irritation while I rambled on about the new food sensation. Joe, she interrupted. What about your mission? Huh? It was fine. Listen, when you bite into the onions, if I promise to come to your parents and eat one of these things, she sighed. Will you give me more detail than it was fine? Honey, while you've been flying around making things happen, we have been stuck here with no idea what's going on in the universe beyond the local wormhole. Sorry. I briefly told her about our mission and the very satisfying results. We made plans to meet at my parents' house the next afternoon. She was on a field exercise and wouldn't be back until the next morning. When we ended the call, I froze. She had called me honey. Not Joe. We crossed that line a while ago, thankfully. She called me honey. That's what couples call each other when they are a couple. In a relationship. She was so comfortable about us, she used a term of endearment without really thinking about it. Damn. Forcing the kiddies to negotiate? A new and exciting kind of cheeseburger, and my girlfriend acting like we're officially a couple. Life is good sometimes. Before I could fly down to the surface and breathe unfiltered air, there was a series of meetings to get through, with Zhao, of course. Thankfully, he scheduled the briefings for late that evening, giving Strebick plenty of time to get a heads up from his staff about what the Admiral in command of the United Nations Navy wanted to focus on. While my new XO worked on that, I called my former XO aboard the battlecruiser Defiant. Jennifer Sims was busy. Her crew was working on simple repairs and preventative maintenance while her ship waited for shipyard space to become available. Defiant had sustained only light damage from the 3 recent battles. At the moment, Sims had her ship lurking in stealth a few light minutes from the planet, acting as a reserve in case aliens found a way through the local wormhole to attack Jaguar base. It was good to talk with her. She told me news I could have gotten from the regular status report, and we discussed fleet gossip that was not in any official report. According to rumors, the damage to Glorious was bad enough that Zhao was holding that ship back from refit, intending to wait until the complete Ragnar station was transferred to Jaguar. By that time, the battlecruiser Furious should be ready to take the place of Glorious in the Third Fleet. The British wouldn't be happy about being one ship short. They and the other nations had best get used to it. There weren't enough resources to keep all the battlecruisers constantly online and... Okay, enough talk about nerdy logistics stuff. Jennifer was busy. She was tired. She was worried about Earth. She was anxious to see her husband Frank again. She was worried about him. Overall, I'd say she was happy. The whole time I'd known her, she worried about everything. Her current command was no different. We made plans to get together aboard her ship before Valkyrie jumped away. I did not tell her about Fluff Screamers. My next meeting was with Emily Perkins aboard the Second Fleet flagship Atlantic. That former Jarrap the battleship, once one of the proudest ships in the UN Navy, was looking a bit shabby already when I arrived aboard a dropship. Priority for resources was assigned to the newer Courageous-class battlecruisers, leaving all the ships we acquired from the Beatles to scrape by with whatever materials they could scrounge from the Fabricator ships. Planned upgrades had been halted in progress, with bundles of wires and power conduits held together with simple plastic zip ties and access panels open, exposing the usually unseen mysterious mechanisms of the ship. "I hope we don't have to jump suddenly," I said to Perkins, only half joking. "The jump drive is in A1 condition," she assured me. "Everything else..." She shrugged and pointed to a bucket full of wires and relays, beside which was a maintenance bot that wasn't doing anything. "With the Legion shut down, the battle wagons and assault transports are lowest priority. We don't have any planets to drop on, and the big guns don't have anything to shoot at." "You do have plans, right? For the Legion?" She ushered me into a conference room where coffee and snacks were laid out on the table. For the next hour, she went through a presentation that was only half finished. She stopped often to talk about issues, though I cautioned that I could only speak for the special mission group. Matters of grand strategy were above my pay grade. I had enough headaches already. "Did Perkins have plans for redeploying the Legion?" "Does Joe Bishop love cheeseburgers?" "Yes!" "She had plans, as in more than one. And they technically were contingency plans, because the Legion's next step depended on factors outside her control. Like the terms Earth would reach with the senior species, about how much freedom clients would have to sign mutual defense treaties with humanity. Which species would even want to deal with us, and what level of support they wanted. What she struggled with was that the primary goal of the Legion had completely changed. The problem was originally the purpose of the new Legion, led by humans rather than Ruhar, was to show the value of a potential alliance with humanity. We had demonstrated the value of a combined human and Verdkris force. Everyone in the galaxy was aware of the Legion's full set of capabilities, especially when backed up by the still-new UN Navy. The galaxy was also aware of how eager the Verds were to get into the action. So now, Perkins had to shift focus to a mission of supporting Earth's policy goals. What policies the UN would want to pursue was a complete unknown. After a treaty was signed with the senior species, would the nations of Earth, weary from years of living with the terror of extinction looming over their heads, decide to pull back to a handful of secure bases and let the galaxy fend for itself? Or would the prospect of access to advanced technology and planets full of undeveloped real estate get humanity in an expansive mood? Perkins knew that whether we wanted to play in our own backyard or expand across the galaxy and beyond, we would be more secure with allies. That meant offering a strong military response to attacks against our allies, and if Earth didn't want to risk putting millions of human boots on alien ground, we needed the Verdkris to be our grunts. Fortunately for us, the Verdkris were eager for action, although it made me feel dirty, like we were exploiting them. Ah, hell, welcome to politics, right? "I would ask if you have any news from the Ruhar." She turned down one side of her mouth in a disgusted frown. "But anything they have to say could change tomorrow." "No news yet," I snorted, knowing she was right. The Hamster government had changed their minds often about relations with us, depending on our fortunes at the moment. Their ultimate decision about whether to formally align with the species they long considered inferiors would probably be driven by necessity, like after events forced them to make a decision. One thing was certain. The Ruha were not taking the big risk of being first to tie themselves to us. They'd been in the war for a very long time and been burned too many times when they took a big risk. I do have news for you. We pinged a relay station before we came through the wormhole. There was a note from our old friend Admiral Cacrondo. Oh? The message is in your queue. Ask Skippy and he'll find it for you. The gist of it is the Achakai are feeling secure on their new homeworld and interested in discussing an arrangement. An arrangement? It wasn't often that Perkins showed surprise. The last communication we had with the ninjas was basically thanks for the help, now get off our planet. We only conducted the operation to screw with the Kristang. And the Wergalan, I reminded her. The Achakai invasion of a Wergalan world had accomplished more than the Legion originally hoped for. The expectation was that after the disgraced Achakai openly broke from Kristang society and tradition, the major clans would grudgingly assist their hated rivals, the Wergalan, to take back the disputed world. The resulting battle would keep the lizards and squids busy, making them unable to cause trouble for the Ruha. Ultimately, the Achakai would be crushed, the Kristang clans would go back to fighting each other, and the Wergalan would hold back a major part of their combat power to guard against another group of ambitious lizards. Instead, the open fighting between the Theranin and Bosphorok, who were patrons, respectively, of the Kristang and Wergalan, had prevented a major effort to push the Achakai off their new homeworld. The ninjas had not been passively waiting for an attack to come. They approached the Black Trees with a deal. The Achakai and two other clans would throw their might into the civil war on the side of the Black Trees in exchange for that influential major clan recognizing the upstart Achakai as a legitimate, if minor, clan. The Fire Dragon clan was outraged to hear of the unholy alliance with the disgraced ones, and the civil war flared up again in a major way. It was likely that war would burn itself out within a year or two, as the Theranin didn't have the time, resources, or patience to help their endlessly bickering clients continue their pointless war. An arrangement, I explained, where the Legion assists the Achakai to end the civil war on terms that are advantageous to the ninjas. Oh my God. God, she gasped. That sounds like an idea you cooked up. I wish, she admitted. The ninjas don't do anything halfway. Ha! She slapped the table. I can't wait to hear what the hamsters think about this development. Would we really intervene in the lizard civil war? She cocked her head at me. You mean intervene again? Well, yeah, I said sheepishly. Damn, you spark one civil war and people keep wanting to remind you of it. The Verds would jump at the chance, she mused. The question is, how would we benefit? End their civil war in a way that leaves the lizards weak and divided? Sign me up for that. Let me read Cacrondo's message, she shrugged. By the time Earth makes a decision, it may be OBE anyway. Welcome to the army, Perkins, I grinned. We talked for a while. Then I got a brief tour of the ship before lunch in the galley. After that, I flew over to Zhao's flagship for a briefing. During the flight, I sat back in my chair in the empty cabin, thinking about the future. If the senior species really agreed to a ceasefire, Perkins might have an opportunity to take the Legion into action again. But what was I going to do? After Skippy cleared the cloud away from Earth, what would be next for me? And for Skippy? The Magnificent One living on Earth was not an option, as long as aliens wanted to capture him, and we had to assume they always would. Leaving him alone was too dangerous. He got into enough trouble even when I was there to limit the damage. Maybe we could settle down at Jaguar for a while. Until aliens got there, either through a wormhole shift or traveling the long way for a surprise attack. No, in the long term, Jaguar was not a good option. That left Avalon. Far outside the galaxy. We would both be safe there. Until Skippy got bored. And we would have to fly back to the Milky Way regularly to make sure the beings there were not getting up to any nonsense. Avalon was a whole new planet to explore. The Sculptor Dwarf was an entire galaxy we knew little about. That could keep us busy for a while, right? Maybe. What I knew for sure was that living way out in the middle of nowhere sounded awfully lonely. My mom would probably think the place was too crowded. It didn't matter anyway. Skippy sitting on the sidelines or enjoying retirement, or however you thought about it, was not an option. Even if we were able to find a solution so the two senior species were no longer a threat to humanity, we still had an even bigger, a much bigger threat looming over our heads. Looming over the entire galaxy. Elder AIs. Except for Skippy, they were all apparently dormant. Or dead, like the insane one he got into a fight with and killed. But Skippy had woken up from his long slumber, recovered from damage sustained in their long-ago war. If he was awake, it was only a matter of time before others became active. If another AI awakened, one that had been on the opposite side of the war, we would be faced with a threat far worse than the fragile egos of the Maxalks. Eventually, and by eventually I mean soon, we needed to begin hunting for dormant AIs so we could kill them before they killed us. Damn it, that's why we needed to get the fucking kitties off our backs. We had more important things to do than worry about them sniping at Earth. Yet another item on my to-do list. I'll get right on it. Someday.